obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
Well, hi, everybody. Welcome to the host city meeting of the 64th Annual Southern California Convention. My name is Joe, and I am an alcoholic. Before we start the meeting, I have a few announcements. In consideration of our speakers, we request that you please turn off your cell phones and put them away. And please, no texting, as this can be very disruptive. There's no smoking in this facility. This includes vaping. We ask that you do so outside in the designated areas. And let us keep in mind that we are guests at this convention center and the hotel, and we represent our fellowship in the spirit of attraction. Please join me in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other so that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We're self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. And I've asked Michelle V. from Indio to read a portion of Chapter 5. Come on up, Michelle.
Thank you. My name is Michelle. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Michelle.
Hi. How it works. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program, usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories are disclosed in a general way, what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. At some of these, we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result is nil until we let go absolutely. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. There is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. Number one, admit we are powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Number two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Number three, made a decision to turn our will and lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Number four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Number five, admitted to God, ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Number six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Number seven, humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. Number eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Number nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Number 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. Number 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. Number 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all of our affairs. Many of us exclaimed, "What an order! I can't go through with it." Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles that we have set down are guidelines to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventure before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. A, that we are alcoholic and cannot manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And C, that God could and would if he were sought.
Thank you, Michelle. And I've asked Kimmy A to read the 12 traditions.
Good afternoon. I'm Kimmy and I'm an alcoholic. The 12 traditions. Number one, our common welfare should come first. First, personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Six, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, or prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seven, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Eight, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9. AA, as such, ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
Thank you.
And thank you, Kim. Okay. I'd like to introduce our 10-minute speaker, Angela M. from Palm Desert.
Well, first of all, I am Angela, and I am an alcoholic. Thank you so much, Joe, for asking me to speak, and welcome to everybody who's from out of the desert and from here in the desert. Welcome to any newcomers, and congrats to anyone who's celebrating a sobriety date. Today is day 800 for me, and yes, I keep counting, because each day is just as important as the last one before. It truly is a program of one day at a time. And, you know, it's funny because, of course, even though it's just 10 minutes, I get all worked up. I'm glad it's kind of a smaller crowd because I'm like, okay, good, you know, because I'm self-conscious. You know, it lists in there saying that alcoholics tend to be a little bit grandiose, a little bit sensitive, and a little bit childlike. I, of course, identify with none of those, but if I did, you know, that might be how I feel right now. You know, I actually, I got sober in the place that I drank a lot. I've been trying to figure out if it was this room or the building over, and I've decided it was the building over, where I got totally wasted about 3 years ago. And so that has been a process, getting sober in the town that I drank in. You know, I started drinking fairly late, about 18 or 19. You know, it's a pretty typical story you hear. I felt different. I felt apart from. I was a straight-A student. I always was trying to do everything right. I was raised in a Christian household. And basically, you know, I hit college and I rebelled from all that. I didn't want to be so good all the time. I felt uncomfortable in my skin and I wanted to be someone different. And alcohol helped me do that. And, you know, it was fun at first, as we always say, you know, and I still remember back in the day, I looked at old journal entries and I mentioned in there when I was 21, I said, yeah, my dependence on alcohol. So clearly some part of me, even back then, recognized my dependence on alcohol. But it took me until about 8 years later to actually realize that I was powerless over alcohol. So, you know, as the progression, you know, I used to just be a weekend binge drinker, so to speak. And then by the end, you know, I really was a nightly drinker. I was coming home from work every single night and drinking and, you know, just the little horrors, as they talk about the incomprehensible demoralization, you know, waking up in the morning and I loved red wine and having to brush the purple off my lips every morning. And, you know, you may have noticed that it's a little hot here in the desert. I would have to work outside in 110 degrees sweating alcohol. And I'm like, you know, it's not pleasant, but I couldn't stop. So even before I really realized it, I was starting to see, I was driving to the, you know, Walgreens, the grocery store, whatever, to get alcohol when I was saying I wasn't going to earlier that day. So, you know, my sobriety date is July 24th, 2013, and the day before, my final drunk really was not dramatic. I really didn't know what else to do. My spiritual awakening really does start the next day, my sobriety date, because I woke up and I had a thought that I really have never had, and God willing, I have now for 800 days and onward, and that thought was, oh my God, I'm an alcoholic and I need to stop drinking. I'm very grateful and thankful and really do believe that everything works and, you know, some higher power is orchestrating things out there, because I had a friend who'd gotten sober 4 months before me and she mentioned these meetings that she went to. So I called her and I was like, so can you try to take me to one of these meetings? And, you know, I did not like meetings for my first month or so. I'm like, okay, my gosh, they're praying in circles, they're chanting, they're doing, and it was very overwhelming. And now, you know, I definitely have become quite the little AA, or, you know, at a little over 2 years sober, I still go to five to seven meetings a week. I have a sponsor. I try to sponsor women. You know, I really have. This has become a way of life. You know, it's not just something I do. It works in me and through me. And, you know, it does. It starts with the theme of this convention, which I kind of chuckled about, because acceptance is one of my least favorite words. I don't know why acceptance has to be the key, but it does. As it says, you know, formerly Dr. Addict, as it says in Dr. Paul's story, you know, I couldn't stay sober until I could accept I was an alcoholic. And gratefully, that day I did say to myself, I'm an alcoholic. And I've been able to hold on to that one day at a time and pray that I will continue to. So, you know, once I did start to really sink in, and I did, I just kept coming back and, great, by the grace of God, staying sober. But, you know, we actually have a boomerang on the back of our wall at Fellowship Hall, and that's it, is keep coming back. And I did. I kept coming back, and things started to sink in. I started, as opposed to thinking, well, I don't hear anyone who's sharing who's like a small-town kid from Montana. Instead, I started identifying with the feelings that I heard. People who identified the same things as me, feeling that they had trouble finding faith in this world. People who didn't feel comfortable in their own skins. And I found people who seemed happy and were smiling. And I found people who genuinely cared about me, because it was hard letting that in. And then, most importantly, as I started working those steps, you know, I love the big book. I love the 12 and 12. And I really do. It is a spiritual program, not a religious one. And it has been incredible finding a little bit of faith each day. And trust me, my faith started with a mustard seed, and by now it's maybe a walnut. but I am. I get to work on that every single day. You know, and each one of the steps, it talks about how this becomes a design for living. In the back of the book, one of my favorite stories is how to handle sobriety. Because, you know, my alcohol was but a symptom. I am the problem. And what's between here is a problem. I have a physical malady. You know, if I drink and if I put alcohol in my system, I'm just going to keep going and I can't say where things are going to go from there. I am mentally different too. I have the obsession of the mind and I'm spiritually different. I don't seem to have, you know, like I said, I need this program in order to have a spiritual way of life. So, you know, I worked those steps, and I'll just quickly go through them because it says I still have 4 minutes. I am timing myself. You know, step one is something I carry with me every day. These steps are something I carry with me every day, but I am definitely powerless over alcohol, and my life is unmanageable. And the second part I can still do in sobriety. Thank God, like I said, I have held on to the top part of step one. Coming to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity, that's part of what brought me into the rooms, is I felt insane. And I was kind of almost hoping I was an alcoholic by that point, too, because I was like, I need some explanation for what's wrong with me. Step three is a really beautiful one, too. You know, step three in the 12 and 12 talks about the key of willingness, and, you know, we're talking about acceptance. I mean, acceptance is the key. And the first time I took step three, I took it with my sponsor up in nature, and we held hands. And actually, ironically, after that, too, we did read Dr. Paul's story, so very interrelated there. But I have tried to orchestrate my own life like that actor upon the stage that it talks about in the big book so much that being able to turn it over is such a relief to not have to be in charge of everything or anything anymore. Step four, I had to look at myself. Step five, I had to share that with another person. Step six, I had to find those defects in myself that caused me pain and caused others pain. And by causing others pain, of course, I caused myself pain. Step seven, I have to accept that, basically one of my biggest problems is fear of not getting what I want or fear of losing what I have. Step eight, I did harm people and I have to be willing to make that right. Step nine, I've gotten opportunities to do so. I think it's very interesting. Just a few days ago, I went two-step dancing, and I ran into a guy who the last time I'd seen him was a month before I got sober, and he's like, by the end of it, he was like, you have done a great turnaround. And so that was amends there, and one I hadn't even thought of that popped up. And then being here, it's hilarious. I'm speaking about my life as a sober woman, and like I said, 3 years ago, I was busy drinking over on the other end. So it does, it works in amazing ways. And then I have to continue to do that. Like I said, it's a one day at a time. Each day is like a little eternity with so many choices and so many opportunities to continue to work this program through me. Step 11, I have to be willing to quiet my head enough. Prayer and meditation, if you can't tell by how fast I'm talking, I occasionally have a bit of a busy head. No, it is. It can get a little exhausting in there. So it's taken a lot of practice. And, meetings are a way of meditation for me, too, listening to you guys. And I hear my higher power through the words that you guys share and speak here at meetings. So step 11 is definitely one of my favorites. And then step 12, of course, passing on the message. I'm so grateful for those who carried the message to me, and I pray that I continue to. And, practicing these principles in all my affairs, like I said, this is not just like one and done. I did think I was going to graduate at first, apparently not. And I don't want to. I like it. I like that, I have sober friends. I have sober people in my life who mean so much to me. I like that I finally, like it says in the book, as opposed to, I used to thank God for bringing me to AA, but now I thank AA for bringing me to God. So with that, please enjoy your time here in the desert. Thank you for letting me share. And I guess acceptance is the key.
Thank you so much, Angela. It was a real joy to have you. And I'd like to introduce a gentleman that's a member of my home group. I'm a member of the Marauders Men's Stag in Palm Desert. We're anywhere from 50 to 90 guys every Monday night. And I just had to plug that meeting since it is the host city. But Jay has become an integral part of our group since he joined us a couple of years ago. From the great state of Texas, now a desert resident, Mr. Jay M.
I'm Jay. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Jay.
Thank you, Joe. Before I forget, I do this almost every time I talk. I just want to say thanks to the powers that may be, Joe. I think you're the one that invited me, and my men's group, and of course. Can you hear me now? Is that better? All right. I always like to say when I start that. If I spent the rest of my life doing,
table fix it.
Adjustment here.
Just acknowledging your heart.
So I always like to say that if I spent the rest of my life doing 12-step work and working with sponsees and going to meetings, and I go to a lot of panels, I do a lot of panel work, but if I spent the rest of my life, the free time that I have, if I donated to Alcoholics Anonymous, I would never be able to repay you for what you've given me, and for the relief you gave my family as well. It's like if you ran into my mother and father right now and told them that you were a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, they darn near break down in tears and profusely thank you, whoever it may be, for giving back their son. And I'm just one of the ones that had pretty rough ride. And I have that reaction to alcohol that a real alcoholic has. When I take a drink, I don't feel funny or different. I feel perfect for the first time in my life. When I had my first drink, and I don't know if this is any indication that I was going to be an alcoholic, but when I decided to drink, I went and robbed a house, stole the alcohol, and me and my buddy went up into his room on Friday night and drank it all, and he threw up and passed out, and I stayed up, cleaned up the mess, and drank all the rest of the booze. And And it was an amazing experience. I just remember thinking when I took that drink and it went down into me and I felt it, it hit my stomach and it started to glow and like flow into my blood and that thing happens where all of a sudden you realize you've been miserable for the last, I don't know, I was 13. So I've been miserable for 13 years and I just figured it out. You know, it was like alcohol was perfect. I felt amazing. I didn't spend any time when I was drunk. I didn't think about what you were thinking so that I could answer. You know what I mean? It was just like life became effortless. I felt connected to you. You were immediately my best friend and there were no problems anymore. And I sought out to do that and you know, recreate that experience every opportunity that I got. And I was raised in a good family. I don't have the horror story, the family horror story that a lot of us have. I know a lot of us come from alcoholic homes and bad circumstance and whatnot. I just didn't. My dad was an engineer. I've never seen him drunk. There was a six pack of Moosehead beer in the pantry for my whole life until I started drinking. And, I think I see him drink like one, over my whole childhood. I think I saw him with one beer, and my mom doesn't drink either. And my mom's a school teacher, and I had every opportunity. You know, I excelled in sports. I was good at school. I was an Eagle Scout. I played basketball. I was a really good swimmer and a soccer player. And then I got so tall that I remember I was in seventh grade and I was walking down the hall and I was 6'2", and this guy comes up to me and he goes, "You're on the basketball team." And I go, "I don't even know the rules." And he goes, "It doesn't matter." And a lot of people didn't like that because there were kids, come to find out, that played basketball every day for hour after hour after hour, and they wanted to be on the basketball team, and I got assigned to it, and they were very resentful. But you know what? I didn't have a bad life, and so alcoholism was in me from the very beginning. When I hit junior high, I started to do weird things like steal everything that wasn't screwed into the ground or mounted on the wall. I just had this thing about taking. I shoplifted. And my father would catch me with all these, like, I'd go steal all these fishing lures, and my dad would catch me, and he'd march me into the store and make me go to the general manager and pay for them and give them back. And I would be horrified, not only that my father was extremely disappointed in me, but I'm having to out myself. Then I'm giving him my money, and I don't get the fishing lures either. You know, it's like, this is awful. And I'd do it the next day. I had consequences did not deter me. You could ground me for a year, and the day I got out, if I didn't escape and run away, the day I was out of being grounded, I'd get grounded again because I just didn't, nothing deterred me from doing what I wanted to do. I always have suffered from this delusion that the rules don't apply to me. And that caused me a lot of trouble because when I drink, I like to do drugs. And I do them alcoholically, and I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and I was convinced I was a drug addict. I didn't really think I was an alcoholic, but I knew I was a drug addict. I understood that. And by the time I got to you guys, I had been to prison two times, and I don't want to get too far ahead of myself, but when I got to AA, and you guys started talking about alcoholism, and I sat for a little while, and I started sharing about my life, and I started listening to you talk about what was going on with you, and I identified with the thinking right away. And a man pointed out to me, who was my sponsor, that, I tried to treat my alcoholism with drugs for a long time, very unsuccessfully. But it always started with a drink, and it always ended with a drink. And most of the time, I was drinking the whole time I was getting high anyway. I went to college. I got a scholarship at a college in Kansas City, Missouri, which was the furthest point away from my parents out of all the schools that I got into all over Texas. This one was the furthest one away, and I was like, well, that's where I'm going. So I went up there. I started, I continued my drinking, which had caused me a little bit of trouble in high school. I'd been brought home by the police a few times, just drunk out of my mind, and nothing too serious. I had beat a kid up in high school. Just a fist fight over a girl, but I hadn't really pulled any I hadn't done anything heinous yet. And when I went to college, I got introduced. What happened was I got up there and marijuana was really valuable in Kansas City, and I could get it dirt cheap in Houston, and I got involved in running it back and forth into the Midwest. My parents caught me with a package one time when I was home on break, and it just happened to be an address to my dad went to that same school, so the kid I was sending it to was my dad's fraternity brother's son, and he saw the package, and they knew that I'd been acting a little bit funny, and that there was a bunch of missing laundry detergent. Things didn't just add up, because I had wrapped it in laundry detergent, so they couldn't smell it, and so they found the package, and they cornered me one day, and I came down the stairs, and...
To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the Month Club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
And my dad and mom had this box that had a bunch of weed in it, like a pound of weed in it or something, and they go, "We want to know what's in here." And I was like, You can't, it's not for you, you know, that's the U.S. mail, you know, you can't do that, it's a federal offense, you know. I was like, trying all that stuff. My dad was like, "We want you to open the box," and I was like, "I'm not opening it," but they opened up the box, and I remember feeling like my life was falling apart, and my dad cut into this bale of tape, and it sprung open, and the room started to stink, and my mother was like, "What is it, Danny?" And my dad goes, "It's marijuana, Lena." And it was this big event, and I got sent to rehab. And I was 19, and I didn't have a problem. So, you know, I mean, it was great. I met a lot of guys in there that needed help, and it seemed like a great place for people that had problems, but I didn't have one. And what happened to me was I was also treated by a doctor that I don't think knew anything about alcoholism or, you know, what we are. He definitely wasn't an alcoholic, because immediately upon being released from this rehabilitation center, he said, "Jay, you're extremely ADD. I want you to meet me in my office." And he gave me these tests, and he was like, "You're extremely attention deficit. We need to treat you with Ritalin." And he handed me a prescription for amphetamine, and I took it, and it made me feel different. And so I immediately started to take more than I was supposed to, and within a couple of months, I was going to college, and I was straightening out my life, and I was snorting my ADD medicine because it worked better that way. And so, you know, I didn't realize this is a pivotal point in my life. I snorted my medication, I got in the car, and I headed off to community college. And when I got a couple miles away from the school, I was going through an intersection, and there was a car in the turn lane in front of me with its blinker on. And when I went into the intersection, I was going about 50 miles an hour. When I got from about here to that wall, the car turned out, and I hit it broadside doing about 50 miles an hour, and I killed the front seat passenger. The car had two old ladies in the front seat and three kids in the back, and the front seat passenger died, and I immediately gave up on life. You know, I was knocked unconscious, and I don't know if you saw the movie Flight, where he wakes up and he's in the bed and they're pulling his blood, and you hear his inner dialogue, like, and all he's concerned about is, like, do they know, you know, I'm screwed. And I woke up in that exact scenario, and I didn't know, you know, like, my concern. I was horrified. I was destroyed. I was like, you know, you've taken someone's life. There's nothing worse that could happen to you ever. And I just gave up. And so what ended up happening was I was charged with negligent homicide, and the test came back negative for drugs, because they don't test for this chemical, and I knew that I was loaded, and no one else did. And so I kept that secret until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous and wrote an inventory in 2007. And I spent 14 years in and out of the penitentiary on drug charges, and I started dealing drugs to cover my habits, and was on probation, was immediately, or not immediately, but about 2 years into it, raided by the Harris County Sheriff's Department and busted with a bunch of LSD and cocaine, sent away for a long time. And fast forward, I got out after about 5 years, couldn't stay sober. knew that drugs and alcohol were the problem, but immediately upon getting released from prison, went out with my friends and celebrated with a beer. And it wasn't a month before I stole a Lincoln Continental after a night at the bar with my friends and ran over a bunch of fire hydrants. And I'm on parole, you know, and I'm like, I don't even remember doing it. So 4 or 5 years later, I'm arrested again on drug charges. I go back to prison again, and now I'm 31 years old. I'm getting tired. You know, I'm like, prison's not fun and exciting anymore. And I've been sentenced to Alcoholics Anonymous this whole time. I'm going into AA, and I'm hating it. But you guys are saying things, and despite how hard I tried not to pay attention and not listen and not be present, I heard things in Alcoholics Anonymous, which would later save my life. And you guys were always talking about this being a chronic, progressive, fatal disease, and that it was never going away, it was always going to get worse, and it was eventually going to make me go crazy, get locked up, or die. I don't know what happened, because I was never afraid to do anything. I was never afraid I was going to overdose. I was not afraid to go to jail. Violence did not bother me. But I came to a point in my life where I remember I was on parole in Texas, and I decided I was going to go to a Grateful Dead show in Atlanta. The plan was to just smoke marijuana and not drink, because drinking gets me in trouble. And I got there and I thought, I'm on vacation, and I had a beer. And I went on a tremendous bender, and, you know, took a ridiculous amount of LSD. And I came to 4 or 5 days later, you know, didn't know where my wallet was, had a parole officer meeting in Houston, was in Atlanta, just completely blown out of my mind, and I crawled back to. I just had this experience where I was like, you know what? I'm an animal. I can't do anything fun, and there's nothing fun about this anymore. I'm dying. I have this disease that they're talking about. I have alcoholism, and I'm dying. And if I don't do something, I'm going to spend the rest of my life in a cage. And I don't want to go there anymore. I wasn't really sure I wanted to get sober. I didn't even think it was possible, because I'd been in that alcoholic life that just slowly gets better over time, to where it's like you don't even know what's happening. And then all of a sudden you're just like this crazed lunatic. Your family doesn't want you around anymore. You're like on this endless journey that never gets better. It always gets worse. And then going home, all it is just like the shameful experience where the people that love you and have tried to help you, they're exhausted. They're furious. They want their money back. You know what I mean? It's like simple things. That's like, you know, it's like I owe my dad like thousands of dollars. And everybody had spent all this money trying to send me to doctors and getting lawyers to defend me. And I just would not stop what I was doing. And I got back to Alcoholics Anonymous in Houston, Texas, and I crawled in for the first time, realizing I was dying. And I was terrified. I was projectile vomiting. I was hallucinating. And I was crying and laughing. And I started listening, man. My parole officer told me that she was going to send me back. And so I had started going to lots of meetings, and I was one of those guys that had that sheet that were like, it was filled up all the way down the front, and then the whole back had lines drawn on it, and the whole back was full. I was going to 6 and 7 meetings a day, and I wasn't sober, but I was going to those meetings. And I ran into this guy that changed my life. He was this little short guy from Baltimore, and he talked about being on the streets and being hopelessly alcoholic and shooting dope in gas station bathrooms. The thing that really jarred my attention was that this man had on a suit, and he was laughing and joking about all these things, and he wasn't where I was anymore. He knew where I was, but he wasn't there anymore. And he always had a big book, and he had a group of guys around him. He owned a restaurant, and he had 60 or 70 employees. Really successful gentleman, and I was just perplexed. I couldn't figure out, you know, this guy has what I had, and now he's not there. And his name was Nick, and I asked him to help me. Nick sat down with me, and I remember I had a gold watch, this old junky, like, drug dealer gold watch. It was, like, the only thing I had left. He said one day while I was listening, he said, if you have a watch left, you're probably not done. So before I went and talked to him, I put it in my pocket. And I was like, if he calls me out, I'll just give it to him. But let's not give it away, you know. And Nick sat me down with a big book. He gave me the book, and I said, Nick, I don't know what to do. I'm going to die. I can't stay sober, and I don't know what to do, man. I'm dying, and I'm going to end up living the rest of my life in a cage. And he gave me a big book, and I said, what do you want me to do tonight? Because I got to, you know, this place doesn't open up till 7 in the morning. And he says, I want you to take this book home and believe that this works. And I don't know why, but I got a little relief from just being told, you know, have some faith. And I knew that he was recovered, and that's why I felt better. I finally felt like this man understood who I was and the problem I was dealing with. And Nick started to take me through the steps. And you know, I was a lunatic, but I did what Nick said. And it was like, I got to the inventory, and I dropped that secret off to him, and I got honest with him, which was a tremendous experience in itself because, you know, for the first time in my life, I had got completely naked, like just completely honest with another individual, and I told him all that stuff. And I'm telling you, I was suffering from PTSD, and I was seeing this wreck over and over in my mind. And for 15 years, it was a part of my life. And I would drink and use it away, and then it wouldn't go away anymore. It didn't matter if I was loaded or if I was sober, it was just there. And it was like a movie. And I gave that man that inventory, and we went over it, and I've never seen that accident in that light again. And my obsession to drink and use drugs was taken at 41 days when I took my third step, and I agreed to start writing the fourth. You know, and Nick said that my third step was a deal to complete steps 4 through 12. And you know, there's a guy named Blind Dave, and he rides around in Texas. He's a speaker. He's a really interesting guy, and he rides in a sidecar, and his girlfriend drives the motorcycle. But he's a great speaker, and one of the things that Blind Dave says is that, you know, if you're having trouble finding a higher power or looking for God and can't find him, do steps 4 through 9, and he'll contact you. And that was my experience. You know, the page 84 and 85 where it talks about in the big book, the 10-step promises, where it says we will cease fighting anything and anyone, anything and anyone, even alcohol, and that for at this point sanity will return, and that, you know, we get placed in a position of neutrality. Like, that's all we're offering here, is that you won't want to drink anymore. You know what I mean? Like, that's what we do here. We treat the obsession. And when I came in, my obsession was so intense that I would lay in my bed on my knees and my arms, and I would rock myself to sleep, praying, you know, please take this from me, please take this from me. And I'm telling you, when I made that third step, I did that third step with that man, and I agreed to write that inventory, and I put pen to paper, I was relieved. And I was shocked. I didn't realize what had happened. For 3 or 4 days, I walked around, and I was like, something weird is going on, you know, like I was suspicious. I knew I felt funny. I couldn't put my finger on it because I had lived with this obsession for so long. It was just a part of my life. It was like I spent all day either drinking or trying not to drink. And I can tell you that when that went away, I have never put any energy into trying not to drink or pick up ever again. It's been gone, and it's stayed gone. And, you know, for that, I am eternally grateful. You know, and so we're talking about God here. This is a job for God. It's not a job that you can, you know, sitting in a seat in AA, it won't do it. Not if you're an alcoholic like me. Service work won't do it either. It'll make you feel better while you're doing the work to get rid of it, but it won't take it. And a good sponsor can't fix it either, man. It doesn't matter how good your sponsor is if you don't do what he says. And my experience was that when I did what was written out in those steps exactly the way that it was said to do it, that, you know, God entered my heart and my life in a way that I couldn't explain. And I remember going to a kid that I had robbed for several pounds of marijuana, and it was a kid that had been sober in the past. He was a good friend. I liked him, you know what I mean? It wasn't just a drug contact, and I had to go to him and tell him I'd stolen all this stuff. And you know, it, of course he knew. He's like, yeah, we already knew that. And but I remember I was riding home from him. I had already done my family, you know, and it talks about, like, you'll be amazed before we're halfway through. Well, you know, before you're halfway through with that 9-step list, I can guarantee you some relief if your heart is earnest and you're willing to do what's necessary. And I was driving home through downtown, and I looked in the rearview mirror, and I was crying tears of joy, and I didn't understand what was happening to me. Well, what was happening to me was I was having a spiritual experience, you know, like I was being cleansed of my past life. And I called Nick, and I said, Nick, I don't know what's going on. I'm crying. And he goes, you're getting better. That's what's going on, you know. keep going. And that was 9 months into my life, you know, my new life, this life that I live today. And so I, on the 19th of this month, I have 8 years sober. And I got off parole in Alcoholics Anonymous. I got handed a job in Alcoholics Anonymous when I had about 4 years. I remember I got down on my knees and I prayed, because I had these crappy jobs where I was working for $10 and $12 an hour. And all it did was pay for an apartment and keep me out of my parents' house, which was one of the first things my sponsor said. He's like, your first amends will be to get the hell out of your parents' house and leave them alone. You know, you're 32. I was 35, 32 at this time. It's time to get out of their hair, dude. It's like, I hate to tell you this, you're a grown man. You know, and it was news to me. I didn't know. And so I did that, and I remember I was going to meetings, and I was listening to people talk about the ninth step and 12th step, and I was hearing them talk about paying all this debt, and I owed $80,000 to you know, all the way around, everywhere, college, people that I'd stolen from, my father, my mother, everyone. And I remember praying one night on my knees and saying that, I said, God, I'll do anything you want. I'll go anywhere you want, and I'll do anything you want if you'll just give me a job that will give me the ability to pay these people back, and, you know, so that I can walk into Alcoholics Anonymous and look people in the eye and know that I've done my best to carry out this work. And I swear, not 2 weeks from the time that happened, this man told me to come talk to him, and I was handed this job doing hotel liquidation. And it was like $100,000 a year. He put me on this traveling crew. I got paid per unit what I got done, and my first job was the JW Marriott here in the desert. And he said, and I remember I was in charge of this $8 million renovation, and I had no idea what I was doing. I go, I don't even know how to do that. And he goes, you'll be all right. You know, he had seen me like running landscape crews, and he knew that I spoke Spanish and that I was good at leading people and just getting stuff done. And he sent me out here, I think, because he was just shorthanded, man. He just didn't have anybody else. And so I showed up in the travel lodge in Indio, and I remember waking up and the sun coming up. I drove in the middle of the night with this other guy, and looked around, and it was like August, you know, and it was hot, but I was from Houston. I didn't care. There was no humidity. I was like shocked. I didn't realize there was places in the world that weren't humid. Because I'd been in so much trouble in Texas, I wasn't allowed to leave my whole life. So I went over to the ABC Club, and I hired all these guys that just gotten out of prison, and we started doing this job, man. I remember I wouldn't even hire you if you didn't have a felony. I was just, I remember, you know how hard it is for us to get jobs, you know, and so I just say that because, you know, I don't care who you are and what you've done. That you know, there's a wrench for every nut here, man. And you know, I have a terrible record. I have a negligent homicide. I have a first degree LSD charge. I have a second degree cocaine charge. I have a 15 pounds of marijuana, possession of OxyContin. I mean, everything you assault, all this bad stuff. So when I go apply for a job, I know, you know what we'll give you a call means, you know. And and I clean up well. You can't tell. You know, it's like. I didn't look like this when I got here, but, you know, God has very much made all those things possible, and it happens all the time. It happens all the time. I'm telling you, I couldn't rent an apartment. I had this terrible time renting this apartment, and I went on this 12-step call one time, and this guy had stolen his wife's Lincoln Navigator on her birthday, and I spent the whole day with him and the police and trying to recover the car, and he'd been, you know, doing dope and was crazy. And that guy got sober, but what ended up happening was I ended up making friends with the whole family, and the daughter had this amazing condo that was right between my parents' house and the AA club. And I remember they paid me to go take something to her one day, and I was talking with her, and I was looking around the condominium, and I was like, this place is so cool, man. I hope when I have like 20 years of sobriety that I have a nice place to live like this, you know. And not 2 months later, I was trying to get an apartment, and no one would rent to me because of my record, and they called me out of the blue, and they're like, hey, Tiffany just bought a house. Do you want to live in her condominium? You know, and that's Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, it happened to me just the other day. I went on a 12-step call. when I had maybe a year sober, and there was this guy named Jimmy had called in on the AA hotline, and I got sober with this this amazing home group in Texas, and so we were taking these calls and fielding these calls and getting these guys, and this guy was, he was out there. He was drinking a half gallon of vodka a day, had a really bad crack habit, and he was addicted to Oxycontin. And so what I was doing with him was, he was so violently sick, we couldn't take him home. There was no, like, we sobered a lot of people up on the couch, but this guy was too far out. And so we would coach him to go to the emergency room and say, I'm going to kill myself. Then they'd put him in Harris County Psychiatric Center, and then they'd had to detox him. And then when he'd get out, we'd try and work with him. And so I did this like six times with this guy. And I thought, this guy will never get sober. There's no way. But he did. He did. And I gave him a year chip before I left Texas, and I stay in touch with him still today. And I had a guy that I was sponsoring out here. A bunch of my sponsees just moved out of the state. I haven't had a lot to do. I had three or four of them go back to Texas. Two went to Texas. One's in South Carolina, and we stay in touch on the phone. But one of the kids that I've been sponsoring is a young man, and he's got about 3 or 4 months. He had just finished writing his inventory, and he has his girlfriend was pregnant, so he moved to Houston where his girlfriend's family was. And I go, when you get there, you call me, and I'm going to hook you up with some AA people in Texas. And so he called me the other day, and I go, great, man. I gave him my sponsor's phone number, and then I called Jimmy that night. And I was talking to Jimmy, and I go, Jimmy, what are you doing? He goes, I'm headed to an AA meeting. I go, look, well, I just talked to this kid, and he just moved down there, and he wants a contact. And I know you're down in that area. And he goes, yeah, I'm going to a meeting in Clear Lake right now. And I call Daniel, and I go, just talk to my friend. He's going to call you. And Daniel's like, yeah, I'm headed to a meeting. And so then the next day, Daniel calls me, and he goes, man, you're never going to believe this. That guy called me, and I was walking out of a club, and I realized when I answered the phone that it was the guy standing right next to me. We were standing right next to each other. You know? And we were on the telephone together, and I was like, man, that's so cool. And so Jimmy now is sponsoring him, and hopefully they've done this inventory work, and they had their own experience in front of them. But, you know, I have an amazing life today. I have, everything's not perfect, but, you know, anytime anybody asks me how I'm doing, I always tell them, hey, it's another day in paradise. And, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous has given me everything I've ever wanted. I live in a great place on a golf course. And, you know, it's a friend's place. I don't own it. But, you know, I got a truck that's paid for, and I have a motorcycle that's paid for, and I have a great job with World Gym. I fix fitness equipment. I got out of the liquidation business. And but, you know, that job was amazing. I traveled the whole U.S. for that man. In 2 years, I worked in New York. I worked in the Midwest. I worked out here. And this was my favorite location. And because when I came here, there was a tremendous amount of young people in Alcoholics Anonymous. And there's 15 or 20 rehabs here. I don't know if you guys have realized this. And then there's this, also this huge community of people that have retired from Los Angeles and San Diego. And they got, I mean, my home group at 7 a.m. went down at Fellowship Hall. There's 15 people in the room with 30 plus. You know, there's guys in there with, my sponsor is 44 years. And this is a very unique environment. If you need to sponsor people, this is a hell of a place to live. You know, I went to a panel this week at Desert Palms. I mean, if you've been to rehab out here in the last couple years, I'm sorry, because you've already heard this pitch. I do a lot of panel work, and I speak frequently and openly about my accident. I can tell you that it doesn't matter what you brought to us. I don't care if you just did a life sentence for murder, if you killed someone on accident in a car. You know, God can handle it. And Alcoholics Anonymous has somebody for you. And so what ended up happening to me, I get asked this a lot, you know, how did you recover from taking someone's life? Because you'll hear this in meetings all the time. They'll say, well, you know, I was really bad, but at least I didn't kill anybody. And I can guarantee you almost every time that's said in a meeting, there's someone in the meeting in there that did. You know, it's invariable. In a group this size, it's more than likely that someone in here has had that experience. And the relief came for me from immediately upon the time that I started sharing it in meetings at my home group. I had men running up to me and saying, you know, after the meeting, Jay, you know what? 20 years ago, I killed my only son in a car accident. I've been sober for 20 years, and I have an amazing life today. And if you do what we do, you'll be all right. And I started doing 12-step calls with those guys, and I started going into rehabs and telling my story. And the very first time I did it, you know, a kid came up to me afterwards, and he had killed his friend on accident. And I was able to look him dead in the eye and say, you know what, you can stay sober with that in your life. And, you know, this is something that happens to me all the time. I received a phone call about 2:30 in the morning when I had maybe 3 years sober. And the kid, I didn't know who it was a strange number. I picked it up, and he opened up with, "I'm going to kill myself." And I go, "Well, why don't you tell me why you're going to do it? You know, if you're going to kill yourself, that's fine, but explain to me why you think that's a good idea." And we talked for about 30 minutes, and he kept saying, "You just don't understand." And I go, "Well, try me, man. I've been through a lot of stuff. You know, I'm a recovered alcoholic. How'd you get my phone number?" And he goes, "I went to Champions, which was my original home group, and they gave me a newcomer packet, and there's about 20 names on it, and I got about halfway through the list, and you picked up." And I go, "Well, why don't you tell me why you think it's a good idea to end your life today?" And he goes, I got drunk, and my infant child rolled between the wall and the bed, and he died of suffocation in the middle of the night. I killed my son." And I go, "Well, look, I don't know what to tell you, man. You probably, you know, this is no coincidence, but I killed someone in 1996, and I got sober, and I've recovered from it. And I can tell you, you know, I can meet you at a 6:30 a.m. meeting, and I can look you dead in the eye and tell you that there is life beyond these type of experiences, you know." And he got sober, man. The kid got sober. And I just thought to myself, you know, what are the odds that this kid called, you know, all those numbers, and I'm the guy that picked up? And I was probably the only guy on that list that had any experience in that arena. You know, that's God working in our lives. It's beyond explanation. It defies logic. This stuff is counterintuitive. I mean, it just doesn't make sense. There's no reason in the world a guy like me that's been through what I've been through should have an amazing life. And it's even stranger because I run into the kids, you know, through Facebook and reunions and whatnot, the ones that knew me when I was drinking and getting in trouble when I was younger. And they know that I went away for like, you know, they know I had like a period in my life where 10, 15 years where I was just a mess. I was just strung. I was strung out on oxy. I was in and out of the penitentiary. And in a lot of cases, I got a better life than they do. And they've been out there, you know, doing what they do, you know, living. This is an amazing program. This is the only disease in the whole world where if you treat it properly, your life is better than when you started. You know, there's no other disease out there with this offering, you know. And so what I love the message of Alcoholics Anonymous because, you know, what we do here is we help each other. That's it. You know, and I remember in the beginning people coming and picking me up when I didn't have a car, and I was very suspicious of them. You know, like, what are you doing? Like, what is this guy? I remember this guy, I called him on Sunday morning. I had about 20 days. His name was Carlos F. And I called him because his name was in my big book. I didn't know him. And I was crying. I said, "Carlos, I really need to be at this meeting." And he goes, "You stay right there." And like 15 minutes later, he's in front of my house with this old beat up truck. And I remember I got in the truck and there was a toolbox where my feet were supposed to be. And I was riding to this meeting. My knees were all hugged, but I was safe, you know what I mean? Like, they came and got me. I knew I was going to be all right. And when I walked into the meeting with him, he went over to a seat with a big book and a cup of coffee. He had gotten up out of the meeting and come and got me. And I was like, what does this dude want from me, man? You know, like, all day I'm at the meeting place trying to figure out what Carlos is trying to get, you know? It's just, jerk, thinks I'm an idiot, you know? I know what you... And I remember I waited till Nick got there. And I go, "Nick, this guy, man, he's trying to hustle me or something, man. And he wants something from me." And Nick looked at me and he goes, "Jay, what exactly do you have that you think anybody wants?" He goes, "You live with your mom. She's probably doing your laundry right now, tough guy. Why don't you go sit down, you know?" And they were mean to me when I got sober, man. They were mean. They were like, "You know, Jay, you're not really, you know," it's like all the tough guys are still in prison, you know. "You made parole, dude. Shut up and sit down." And they would send me on these errands, man. They, you know, and they gave me jobs. I remember they were like, "What do you do for a living?" And I was like, "Well, I grow weed. I'm really good at, I grow awesome weed." And they were like, "Poof, you're a landscaper now." And I started cutting grass. And they just had the most fun with me. So, you know, welcome. I don't know, how am I doing on time, Joe? I got
couple minutes?
Yeah.
Okay. So, you know, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. This is the only place in the world where the worse you look when you get here, the more we like you. You know, I mean, it's just, it's a phenomenal place to be if your life's a mess and you're out of road. You know, I ran out of plans. That's what happened to me is I got to Alcoholics Anonymous and I just didn't have any ideas left. I didn't have any gas left in the tank. There was nowhere on the horizon where I could go where there was somebody who would say, hey, Jay, come over here, because I'd burned everybody. And, you know, today I have a brand new life. You know, I have a brand new life and I got more friends than I have time for. And I just feel extremely blessed to be a part of this community and this recovery community. And if there's anything I can ever do to help you, please let me know. Thanks.
Thanks again, Jay. Let's thank Jay for a great talk. I'd also like to thank Angela for her 10-minute talk. Our readers, Michelle for Chapter 5. Kimmy for the 12 Traditions. And Pete, in just a minute, is going to read a vision for you. I want to take this opportunity to thank the committee for asking me to be able to lead this host city. Thank you, Larry, for nominating me. It's always good to be of service to Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you for attending this meeting. We will now have Pete read a vision for you and lead us in the Lord's Prayer.
Enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.